So what's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Mazer Fitness Explanation Hour, and today's guest is someone I highly, highly respect. His name is Eric Helms, and he is a natural bodybuilding competitor. He's a powerlifter, 3DMJ coach, exercise science researcher, and author of the first two books that I read on training and nutrition called The Training and Nutrition Pyramids. Right, Eric?
Correct. Thanks for having me. And those are the first books you read? I'm
on
honored.
Training and nutrition, yeah.
Wow. Okay, cool, man. You get some good taste. At least that's my not very humble opinion. So.
Yeah, they got recommended to me by, I think it was a guy called Vitruvian Physique on YouTube. Do you know him?
I think I've heard of that YouTube channel. I would have to look at it to know exactly what we're talking about. That sounds familiar.
Yeah, I contacted him because I wanted to start an online coaching business, and I highly looked up to him. Mm. And I was like, yo, how did you start? And he was like, I think you know you need some knowledge. And he was like, Google Eric Helms' books. They are like the Bible of bodybuilding to me. So that is what I did, and I ordered those books, and now I read through them like 3 times already. So awesome books, Eric. Thank you so much for those programs. So tell me a little more about yourself. What keeps you busy on the daily?
Well, I've got a fair amount of things going on in my life. I train. I lift. I do that. So that takes up a solid, you know, like 6 to 8 hours of the week, which isn't that much. But yeah, besides that, I spend a lot of time with my wife and my friends. Got a social life, nice and healthy.
Awesome.
So I've got a few things kind of cooking at the moment. I spend a few days per month working on MASS, which is Monthly Applications in Strength Sport. Mm-hmm. That's myself, Greg Knuckles, and Dr. Zervis' research review targeted for strength and physique athletes, the coaches of them, and anyone interested in, you know, body recomp and training. So that's, awesome. You know, a few days where I work on a video and two reviews. And then there's day-to-day operations with 3D Muscle Journey. I have a few clients I work with at the moment, and just our weekly meetings with the rest of the team, so we can make sure we're doing the job we set out to, you know, provide information to the drug-free fitness community. I'm a research associate just starting up in June 1st is when I'll be starting at AUT, which is Auckland University of Technology. I'm completing my PhD. I'm going to be submitting it within the next week. So hopefully if that goes well, I will be on as a research associate and working on mentoring new master's and PhD students in my area. So that'll be a fun opportunity to kind of keep my ear to the ground and stay involved in research. So fair amount of things going on.
You got a lot going on, and I don't know how you manage all of those things, but seems like an awesome life you have out there in Australia. So, New Zealand, is it right?
New Zealand, yeah. Yes, correct.
So you moved there a year ago?
Yeah.
2 years ago?
Actually, 2012. I came out here in 2012.
Oh, that's a long time ago.
Yeah, it's almost been 5 years now, but which is pretty cool to look back. But I started my my Master's of Philosophy, or my Master's I did prior to my PhD in late 2012, finished that late 2013, and then I've been working on my PhD since. So, yeah.
Awesome. So how long does that PhD take you to complete?
It's individual, obviously, depending on, you know, okay, your schedule and what you do. Most people here take about 3 to 4 years. So okay. I'm right in there, kind of like 3 years and a couple months.
Awesome. So almost finished up.
Yep.
Almost a researcher. Great, man. So tell me a little bit more about exercise science. What is it exactly, and how do you guys research that?
Yeah, so essentially, exercise science is like any other applied field, and what by applied I mean is it's trying to inform practice in the field. So we're trying to tell, you know, clinicians of whatever type of their next physiologist working with, you know, cardiac rehabilitation, or with their personal trainer, or with their strength and conditioning coach, we're trying to provide information to people so they can find the best way to get favorable adaptations to improve health or performance, depending on, you know, what area they're in. So like in applied research, this study basically comes down to isolating variables, controlling for confounders, and then testing so that we can get an idea of what cause and effect is determining what outcome. So for example, one might compare high intensity interval training for cardio versus steady state, and see how that affects people's heart health over an 8 week period. And that could be used to inform, practice. And you'd randomize everyone to get into each group. You would make sure that everything they're doing was the same except for the actual training intervention itself. And then as the researcher, you would be supervising, ensuring the protocol was done as planned, and then eventually running a statistical analysis to get an idea of what you can take from the outcome, whether that was something that was a true effect, what was the probability, what was the likelihood, what was the magnitude of the effect, and then you make some conclusions and try to publish that work in one of the many exercise science journals that hopefully will be read by a practitioner and then get put into play. It is not always read by practitioners. It depends on the practitioner. Like, unfortunately, it's not like personal trainers are always reading journals, but some jobs that occurs, like strength and conditioning coaches or exercise medical professionals.
Yeah, because I heard you advising people who are not into science or research or anything like that, just don't read it at all, because you probably don't understand it or interpret it very, very wrong. Is that something you advise to new coaches as well?
Well, I wouldn't tell them never to read research. I think that's a little, I'm not discouraging people from reading research. It's just that it's important to learn how to read research before you try to take things away. You're more likely to make an error in interpretation if you don't understand anything about scientific research. So, So there's a lot of ways to learn how to read research. There's a number of people who have created like reading research documents. So for example, at Mass, one of the things that subscribers get is a 15-page reading research document in the resources, where we really try to help someone go through that process. And we encourage people to subscribe to other research reviews, depending on whatever their interest is, like Alan Aragon's or Brett Contreras and Chris Beardsley's. And then they can look up the full text, look at how the person they're following interpreted it, and see what's different. So I think learning to read research does take years to be effective at interpreting
it. Definitely.
So I do think people should be reading research. I just think that it might be too much of an ask for a personal trainer who's 18, 19, 20, 21, who doesn't have even a bachelor's degree necessarily in exercise science, to be expected to read something that is being used to inform other researchers who are PhDs. So I think, yeah, research is a great thing. It should be read. But clearly there's difficulty in interpreting it, or I wouldn't be able to make money doing Mass. You know, there wouldn't be a market for it.
Yeah, that was me last year. I was just reading articles, and I was like, I don't even understand anything of it. Let me just look it up on YouTube, and people simplifying it, like you just simplify it on your own channel and 3MJ's channel. It's just way more easy for people like me to see you simplify it than just read the entire study and don't even understand anything of it and just throw away like 3 hours of your life.
Yeah, I think I do think people should. I mean, the downside to that is then you have to assume that my interpretation is correct. And I'm a human like anybody else, and yes, I have areas that I have blind spots in my knowledge. So that means you're going to be kind of a victim to my ability to interpret. If I do a good job, hopefully I will, point out areas that I don't know, or things that, might be interpreted one way or the other. But you can only state what you don't know so well, because sometimes you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
So I would say that probably the ideal plan for someone would be to, okay, I'm going to start by, following a research review, following some evidence-based professionals out there who are interpreting research, and then also alongside that, read the research on your own and try to develop the skill of reading research, and ideally, go to school for this. And then if your goal is to be able to read research and interpret it, and to the same skill level of the person you maybe were watching 5, 6 years ago, then if you do all those things over time, you will eventually have that same skill set. That's really what I did. That's no different than the pathway I took, where at first I identified a few people who I thought were intelligent, good critical thinkers, and weren't trying to sell me on something, or weren't being hyperbolic and weren't overstating anything. And I followed them, and I tried to figure out how they thought. because not just memorizing their information, but trying to figure out the way they thought about things and how they always played devil's advocate in their own head to develop critical thinking. And that's kind of what I modeled myself after. And I think I was able to follow people who were putting out good information before I was able to actually read a research review, or rather read research effectively. And I think that's normal.
That's normal.
So I think there should be a kind of a pathway of teaching yourself how to do it. And you don't want to be the person who can't get any information until you develop that skill, or that's 6 years of, you know, just banging your head against the wall. So.
Yeah, definitely. So as it comes to exercise science, why should we as, well, let's just say someone is a beginner to novice lifter, and why should they care about what science says? I mean, there are so many people out there on the internet, on social media, Instagram, YouTube, all sorts of things that give out tons of advice. And why shouldn't we just listen to the big dudes on YouTube? I mean, they should know what they're doing.
Well, and they probably do themselves. And I think a mistake a lot of people make is that they think it's either completely disregarding the information that's anecdotal or from, you know, experts in the field or athletes and focusing on science, or you forget those lab coats and the science and you only focus on the people in the field and the big guys, as you're saying. And really, both are valuable pieces of information. Mm-hmm. Like the hierarchy of evidence that is promoted in evidence-based practice, which originally came from evidence-based medicine, is that you kind of have this pyramid of importance. It's different than my pyramids. It's that the top's the most important, and you have like your meta-analysis or your systematic reviews, which is basically taking a whole bunch of randomized controlled trials, like the one that I described earlier on cardiovascular training, and taking a look at what is the most dominant outcome, and that informs, you know, practice. Then once down is a single randomized controlled trial, then is observational research or other studies and case studies, and then finally at the bottom you have expert opinion. It's still on the pyramid because that's very useful, because you know, research has to be informed something.
Definitely.
And you know, high quality expert opinion is still pretty useful if you've got an experienced coach who uses the quote scientific method in their training, where they're trying to change one variable at a time. That's a whole lot of essentially informal observational research that they have to provide for you. Mm-hmm. But not all expert opinion is of equal value. For example, if you're just following some big guy who's not even a trainer on YouTube, and he's telling you what worked for him, you have to wonder how many of his followers does he have who have as good or better physique he does. And it's probably none. So let's say he's got 100,000 followers. That means his approach is as effective as it appears to be for one out of 101,000 people. So is that really an approach you want to be following? Probably not, you know?
Yeah, and that is probably because that big dude on YouTube just forgets to give all of his following like one little piece of information about himself. And that is just the fact that he's on steroid and his body just works completely different than as us naturals, right?
Well, I don't think it works differently. It's just that it works much more effectively. And it may even be that some of his followers are also on steroids, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to get the same level of results.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it also doesn't teach you to think. Like if you think, oh, I'm just going to do what he did. What do you do if it doesn't work? You just find the next big guy to follow? And how much time do you want? Yeah, so how many guys are on YouTube who are just jacking and tell you what they did? Probably hundreds. So you're going to try to, if you're at all intelligent, you're going to follow one of these programs for at least 2, 3, 4, 5 months to see if it works. So we're talking about how many years of wasting your time hoping that one of the people you follow is going to have, you know, an approach that works really well for you, instead of following or at least starting somewhere in the ballpark of going, okay, what is the current meta-analyses, what do they suggest as far as how much volume, frequency, intensity should I use? And I start in that ballpark, and then I individually adjust. You're probably going to get to an effective program much earlier doing the latter than just simply rolling the dice and hoping that the random YouTube person you followed has an effective approach that's going to work for you.
That's very interesting what you're saying. Because when I started out 3.5 years ago, I was like, yeah, just Let's just download a workout plan from bodybuilding.com and then just follow that and see what happens. And I stick to it for like 2 months and I was like, this doesn't work. Let's just hop on to the next one. And I did that for a year or so. And then I stumbled upon your books. And yeah, they just completely changed the way I trained. I watched my nutrition more closely. I got more into the flexible dieting side of things because it just works for me. And I know a lot of people who just can't work with it because they tend to overeat for like 400 calories while they're in a deficit. So some people, it just doesn't work. And you, like you said, you just gotta find what works for you and take an approach that works for you. Because if it doesn't work for you, you probably won't stick it for a long time, right?
Yeah, adherence is the most important thing. You have to find an approach that can be that you can follow. So whether something is optimal on paper or not, it doesn't matter. Practicality is always more important than optimality in the real world.
And that's something you preach in your book, right?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean that's everything. That's the bottom of the pyramid in both of them,
Yeah.
behavior and lifestyle and adherence. So yeah.
Awesome. So now we have all of this science and it's all out there in the books and on the internet, on PubMed, etc. So how do we actually implement this in our training programs after reading
Yeah,
all of it?
that's probably the second biggest or the biggest hurdle. One is actually figuring out how do I make sense of research, which we talked about. And the second is then once you've actually correctly interpreted and read research, is what do you do with it? And that is a big hurdle too, because studies tend to be highly sanitized and they're not very realistic. Even applied research has to make a lot of concessions to where it's more important to control variables and answer a question than it is to try to test the perfect program, which doesn't exist anyway.
No, definitely not.
So it's a study is never going to tell you how to train, but it can give you a concept. So as my friend Dr. Mike Zerdos likes to say, that the most important things to get from research is a concept, and then how to integrate it. So first, you need to conceptualize. Is you need to figure out what is the message I'm getting from the study. Does it really matter? Is the message really supposed to do power after hypertrophy before strength? Or is it telling me that after a high volume, damaging, and fatiguing workout, a low volume workout is a useful way to get training in, but also to allow for recovery before I then do the most important day, the strength day, if I'm, let's say, a powerlifter? That's a conceptual understanding. A literal understanding is I need to do the order of hypertrophy, power, strength because science. You know, that's not a very useful understanding. The second one is, because then you can go, okay, how do I apply this to a 4-day-per-week program? How do I apply this to a 5-day-per-week program? How do I apply this to the goals of a bodybuilder? Do I need to be doing singles at 8%? No, I'm a power lifter, but I do need to be doing less volume to allow recovery. So that kind of understanding is what you want to get from research, is a conceptual understanding. Because once you understand the concept, then that step into integration is much easier. But if you have trouble with conceptualization, then you read all these studies, you understand their outcome, but your training still looks like a 1990 Flex magazine article, because you don't know what it means or how to actually, you know, change what you're doing. So that is the trick, and that's really takes some critical thinking. It takes putting the study back into the big picture of the other information that's out there, and kind of the broader context of exercise as a whole. So that takes time. And it does take more foundational knowledge. And some journal articles are better at this than others, like the ones that have a application section versus a discussion. It's also important to focus on the right research. I think a lot of people will sometimes, they don't understand that there's a difference in value between, let's say, an animal study that's measuring muscle protein synthesis rates versus a study on humans that's actually measuring hypertrophy and changes in cross-sectional area over time. One can be the first one, really just a general hypothesis, and should only inform other research. The latter might actually tell you what to do in the real world in training. So, as a practitioner or an athlete, you always want to be looking at the applied research. Because ideally, research should go from, you know, observational to mechanistic to then finally the applied research before it then comes to practice. So, we're making observations, just looking at correlations, then we're testing to see if those correlations are actually causation. Typically in an animal model first or in a petri dish, and then finally end up doing a true, you know, controlled trial where we're testing the outcome we actually care about. And in this case, you know, strength, hypertrophy, body fat loss, or whatever. So if you're looking at a study that just tells you about pathways or what happens in a mouse, that's probably not something you want to use as the final word on how to modify your training, unless that's all there is, which sometimes
Yeah, that
happens.
is the point as well. If there is no more research for that specific subject, then you should either go from that little mouse research that has been done, or you can just guess something. But that is something I don't like, and I don't think you like that as well. Like, right, as a coach.
Well, you have to, basically your level of confidence in what you're doing should decrease or increase based on the level of evidence you have to use. And honestly, more often than not, you're going to be working with some blend of limited research and expert opinion. Unless you have like six meta-analyses on a topic, you're not going to be able to have, you know, really high confidence in something. I have confidence in prescribing on average for the general person their starting volume, intensity, and frequency, because I do have six meta-analyses or so for those variables. But when it comes to like specific macronutrient breakdowns, or when it comes to specific frequency patterns, or peri-workout nutrition, or refeeds, or many of the things that I do, those are based on pretty weak evidence, and then a combination of that with my experience as a coach and what I've talked to other coaches about. And I think that is the best you can do.
It
so
is.
Long as you update that over time as better research comes out, then you're doing the right thing. But you can't be paralyzed by a lack of good research. That won't, I mean, that's not very useful to pretend something doesn't exist, or to not touch it at all, or not have any confidence at all in what you do, so that leads to inaction if you don't have evidence. So it's a balancing act.
Yeah, you got to do something, right? I mean, you can't stick with the same plan for like 3 years, because, well, you just get tired of it in the first place, and in the second place, your body will start to adapt a little bit less to the training, right?
Yeah, you definitely need progressive overload.
Yeah, definitely. So, what you were saying is, you have confidence in yourself as a coach with all your experience, and that is something that intrigued me to become a coach, because I was doing it all by myself and I was implementing everything I knew into my life, and then I was like, yeah, it's all fun changing my life through fitness and nutrition, but I want to take it to the next level. I really want to help people get started in fitness, and when they get started, I want to help them reach their next level. And like you said, I can do it with myself, but if I can do it with more people, that only increases my confidence. So that's a good point you made there. Next question I have lined up for you is, what would you recommend beginner lifters to read? To read a lot about lifting before they step into the gym, or just get in there and try something and see if it works?
I definitely think they should just start and experience lifting. It's useful to get information, but if trying to get the perfect program or the perfect diet is actually delaying you getting into the gym,
yeah,
I think that's less helpful than action. Especially as a beginner, you know, you're spending all this time worrying about what's optimal, when almost anything you do that has any kind of basic level of logic is going to produce maximal results, because progressive overload, you know, dictates that if it's more than what you're currently doing, you're going to adapt. And so if you're not doing anything, just getting to the gym and doing something is going to have large effects. And I look back at when I made the best gains of my life. It was the first 6 months to a year I was training, and I wasn't training very intelligently, but it was extremely effective, and it's more effective than even 2 years later doing a really, really evidence-based, quote-unquote, program. And that's just because I was a novice. So
that is with everyone, right? I mean,
yes.
There's a reason they are called the newbie gains, and that is, in my opinion, the most fun to train, because the results just fly around, and just learning so much about fitness and nutrition and everything was, in my opinion, the best time I ever had in the gym. Even though I was like looking around in the gym, looking at people, are they looking at me? Am I doing everything right? But just experiencing the gym, like you said, it was a great experience. And now I get more into it, and I think you have had this as well. You just start to take it a little bit for granted that you know everything, and you're just going through the movements. That I think at least that is what I'm experiencing right now. So, do you have any tips on how do I put this on getting back to that beginner state, not in the case of results, but just enjoying it? Because in my personal training, I'm like getting through the movements and then going back home, coming to work, and then just not enjoying it as much as I did back when I began.
Yeah, it's like a relationship, you know, when you first even a very good relationship, when you first start, there's that kind of honeymoon phase, where the passion levels are very high and it's all you can think about. It's exciting, it's scary, so it's very, very stimulating. And you know, when you're in the gym, progress comes very quickly. So that is motivating in and of itself. And all the knowledge you're getting is also completely new to you, and exciting, and it's so you're learning things, you're seeing your body change, your mind's changing, you're developing a new social clique that you're a part of, if you will, you know, meeting people from the gym and finding other people interested in fitness. Your social media landscape is going to change, so your life definitely changes substantially in the first 6 months, maybe a year of lifting weights. And you just like you would in a relationship, you settle into a more comfortable pattern, and it's not a bad thing, you know. Just like a relationship requires constant work and checking in to make sure that everyone is both parties have their needs met, and that you're growing together and you're building something that's a partnership. Your relationship with lifting needs to be the same way. Commitment eventually replaces passion, but that's not to say that you shouldn't still be in love with what you're doing. So it's important to ask yourself, if are you still motivated by what you're doing? Are you still chasing down the goals that you want? And are you still enjoying the process? And if you're not, then you need to take a look at and go, right, what can I modify and change to make it more exciting and make it more fun? Because there's so many things that fall under the umbrella of what makes sense. You know, there's a frequency of 2 to 3 times per week as a place to start can look a lot of different ways. That could be 6 upper lower days in a row. That could be 3 full body days with more time off. And just depends on what you want to spend your time doing in your life. You can do different exercises. If your goals are hypertrophy, you can have a little more variety. If your goals are powerlifting, then you know you have to use the big three. But obviously, how they're performed and what rep ranges and all that, you have a fair amount of wiggle room with. So I think it's very important to check in and recognize that a goal should be to have fun in your training. Not just because
Definitely.
training's fun, and it should be, just because that'll actually also improve your outcome over time, as your level of motivation and training and your likelihood to hit all your sessions and get through the hard days is much higher when you're enjoying the process.
Definitely. And just a question that popped into my mind right now. Do you think the gym you train at has a little influence in your enjoyment of your training? Because that's something in my personal training as well. The gym I train at is just a recreational gym, like Planet Fitness would be in the USA. Just something like that.
Yeah,
And it's.
definitely. Your environment is so critical to enjoying the process. I trained at commercial gyms for a long time. I was also a personal trainer, so I trained on my own in studios sometimes. And most recently, I've had the opportunity to train for the last 3 or 4 years in an Olympic weightlifting club, alongside a bunch of other competitive Olympic weightlifters. And that is, for me, a much better environment than your average kind of commercial gym, where people are in there of all different levels of knowledge, experience, and politeness, if you will. And I have no problem training next to people who are novices or new to fitness, not any problem at all. But sometimes to have a little more space and an understanding that we're all here with a similar purpose is more motivating, to be
Definitely,
next to
definitely.
someone who's trying to train for, you know, New Zealand Olympic lifting nationals is awesome when I'm doing the same thing in powerlifting, and there's a lot more camaraderie, and everyone understands what everyone else is doing. And
yeah, you don't get all of those weird looks coming at you when you're slamming a deadlift or something.
Yeah, you don't have someone who asks you, or you don't have a personal trainer who tells you you shouldn't be arching your back when you're bench pressing. I mean, if you think about it, that's like someone going up to someone doing the high jump and saying, "Well, why are you going over it backwards? You know, you should just jump over it and hurdle it. You know, that Fosbury flop, that doesn't look good for your lower back." And it's like, come on, man. You know, I'm a competitive athlete here, so it can be a little frustrating to have to deal with that. It's for me, it's rare that people will do that, but I know for some people. That happens a lot more often. Like I've seen women tend to often run into someone who feels they need to tell them what they're doing. I've seen national level power lifters who are women who've had trainers come up to them and tell them how they should be bench or squatting just because they assume they don't know what they're doing. And they're probably actually stronger than the trainer who's, you know, 19 and has a certification from a weekend course and doesn't even know what powerlifting is. So I can understand why some people really want to get out of that environment. Other people like it. I don't mind the commercial gym environment. I think it's good to see, especially if there's a good crowd there and a good atmosphere. That can be nice. But I personally really like training in a weightlifting club.
That's awesome. That's literally inspiring what you're saying, because I am thinking of starting my own gym, and around my area there are just a couple of very expensive gyms and one cheap gym which I go to, and it's just a very commercial gym, but there's nothing in between there. And me and some friends of mine are thinking about setting up our own personal training studio, in which we just train people from all kinds of backgrounds, schools, everything. And we're thinking about opening that up to the public as well, but just some vague plans right here. But yeah, I want to get out of that environment, just get so many looks in there, like, what are you doing? Like you said, you're arching your back when you're bench pressing, and people come up to you like, "Yo, what are you doing?" And I'm like, "Yeah, please leave me alone, because I know what I'm doing, and I know how it should be done, and I know how I want to do it, so please just leave me alone." Another thing is, I think it was you, because I've been spending a lot of time with you, your podcast from 3DMG, and all sorts of content from you. You once said that you can't watch 90% of the people doing isolation exercises.
Oh, yeah. Like, or even just machine work. It's sometimes shocking what someone can do with a lat pull down, you know, when it looks pretty straightforward. It's just you sit there and you pull the bar to your clavicles and then you go back up. But people manage to turn it into like a leaning back row or going behind their head, and obviously they don't have the external rotation for it, or all kinds of things, turning into tricep push down at the bottom. Yeah, I mean, it's difficult for me because the personal trainer in me wants to go help them, but, you know, unsolicited advice is advice you probably shouldn't give. So yeah, and it's not that I think those are bad people or I'm gonna make fun of them. It's just cringeworthy. Yeah, it's just not an environment that is, I find, inspiring for a competitive athlete. Yeah,
and in my very honest opinion, I find it a little bit disturbing seeing people just not knowing what they're doing, and then after they're done. This literally happened to me today. Someone was doing, like you said, the lat pull down, like this with your shoulders or something. I don't even know how we managed to do it. And an elderly woman got onto that machine after he did. And she was doing it completely fine, in my opinion. And then he just walked up to her like, "Yo, what are you doing?" And I was like, "Here we go again." And I literally didn't want to interrupt them, but I just walked up to them and I was like, "Yo, dude, just calm down, please. Because what you were doing is wrong, what she's doing is right. So please just go train on your own. And if you don't know anything about it, leave other people alone. Please, please."
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so the commercial gyms have that to deal with for sure.
So, I have one more question lined up for you, but we'll come on more questions along the way with this question because it's a long one.
Sure.
Science is, in my opinion, the holy grail, but in some cases, like we discussed earlier, we want to direct someone to coach on another course. So, when do you think you should just trust your gut and believe in your own decision rather than trust the science? Where is that that line?
I don't see science as the holy grail. I think
Okay.
science for a
Interesting.
coach has some initial application, but then after that, on a one-on-one basis, you're almost completely basing it on what's happening with them. So when I
Interesting.
first write a program for someone, I'm going to be looking at, what their starting application had and what level of experience they have, how long they've been training, and then I might make some small modifications or large modifications to it based on how it aligns with what we think is best practice. But then from there, I'm not looking up research studies before I tell them what to do. Like every week, I'm going to be
No,
just
no, no.
adjusting based on what they're doing. So that means that 90% of the interactions I have with a client are not informed by science. Evidence-based practices should be like one third, informed by science, one third the personal preferences and individual needs of that client, and then one third informed by your experience,
Okay.
because science really doesn't give you the tools to it doesn't teach you how to coach.
No, definitely not.
Science is really just the methods you use as a coach. So I think science might be more important in different scenarios, but for a coach, I think it is just one. It gives you more tools in your belt, and it can help you, when you first set things up, or if you run into a not necessarily normal occurrence. Like sometimes I have random things in my brain that I've learned that are helpful. Like, oh, maybe I should try a higher fat, lower carb approach. I just found out this client of mine has PCOS or something like that, or
So what is that exactly?
polycystic ovarian syndrome. So it just means that the person has a hormonal status that makes them a little more insulin resistant. So they would probably do better with a higher fat, lower carb diet. It's just a random example of something that if you have that under if you read that in the research, you might be able to be more effective in that situation. I can think of a few things like that. Like, oh, most people take, melatonin at 1 milligram or 5 milligrams, but in some cases it can be just as effective at 250 or 500 micrograms. And if you're having issues with side effects or problems from it, maybe we can reduce the dose and be just as effective. So little things like that are just things that are popping in my head from having read research. And you won't have those skills if you haven't read research or if you don't have some type of reference material. Like I'll often go back through like the AARR archives and think, what was that one article I read a while back? I'll just do like, control F on the page, try to find the topic, or
Okay.
go through a bunch of research studies I have saved on my computer. So there are times when just a random weird thing will come up in coaching, and you'll have to kind of dig and back in the recesses of your brain and your hard drive to figure out if there is, was there something that could help you in that situation? That's pretty normal that. So, for example, with 3DMJ, we have an RD, and then Steve Taylor, and then myself, who is basically our keeping us up to date with science consultant guy. And so, I'll often every once in a month or so, one of the other coaches will message me and say, "Hey, I've got this situation. What do you think?" So those are the only times besides setting up an initial diet where I will need to consult the literature, and it's obviously going to be different in different fields, like a surgeon. Who's going to be trying a new experimental surgery? Obviously, is going to be looking up, a case study where this was used and reading that, and then also probably trying to get in touch with the surgeon, going to conferences and all that stuff. So, it just totally depends on the situation, your field, and whether it's your initial interaction with a client or ongoing. But yeah, I think science, the best way I like to put it is that it's the broad brush strokes when you're first painting a wall, but all the detail work is going to be based on the interactions with the person and modifying what is already in place.
So the basic principles, right? Just the base structure of the program is all mostly scientific basis. And now what you put on top of that is preferences, goals, needs, everything your client wants and obviously needs in order to attain that goal. So with you guys at 3DMJ, you only coach physique athletes or bodybuilders or powerlifters, right?
Or people who want to do that in the future, okay. and at any level. If someone is, I've never competed before, I've been lifting weights for a year, okay. But I'd like to eventually do a powerlifting meet or compete in a physique competition, then we're happy to work with them. We have two programs. We have our Skype consultations, and we also have our week-to-week coaching. Our week-to-week mm-hmm. coaching is pretty much reserved for contest prep or people who are coming out of a contest prep. But we do Skype consultations with a broad variety of people, even if they don't have interest in competing.
Okay, awesome. So, with contest prep, there's a lot of personal needs and goals and all of that sort of stuff. Because you might encounter someone who wants to be stage ready in like 8 weeks and needs to drop 20 pounds. And that's just, well, it could be done, but
shouldn't
not
be
preferable.
Yeah.
So I think in your field with all of the higher level athletes or just people who want to shred down to like the lower digits body fat, you guys need to be implementing a lot more of the personal things. But in my personal profession as a coach, I try to take on clients who get started in fitness or want to take their beginner to novice level just to the complete next level. And do you think I should implement more science than personal preferences? Because, of course, a lot of people who get into the gym the first time, they see this and then they want to try it, and then I as a coach tell them like, yo, please calm down, let's just stick to your program right now, and if we rewrite your program in a couple of weeks we could potentially try that. But yeah, when people get into fitness they want to try a lot of things, and as a coach you just need to calm them down, right?
Yeah, to some degree. I think adherence and personal preference is more important for non-athletes because, you know, bodybuilders, powerlifters are generally motivated by progress and success because they have very clearly defined goals. So I find myself modifying the programs of bodybuilders and powerlifters less. It's totally based on whether or not they're progressing. And mostly based on that. And then, of course, as much personal preference I can incorporate while they're still, you know, marching towards their goals as efficiently as possible, because that's what they want. When I was a personal trainer, though, I would try to fit in as much personal preference as I could while still having a successful structure. Obviously, if they wanted to change their training program every week, then we have a discussion of like, you know, if our goal is to reach X, Y, and Z, it's very difficult to do that if we can't have any way of tracking progress. So there's always going to be some push and pull. And I think once you educate your clients as a personal trainer with, you know, what are the basic fundamental principles that we use to get from point A to point B, then they tend to be a little more on board. But like accessory movements or the type of cardio they're doing little things thrown in at the end are fair game to keep it fun, you know. Like, let's say we're trying to increase their overall strength and general fitness. They might be doing cardio and resistance training, and I might keep the general compounds like an upper body push, an upper body pull, a hip hinge, and a squat movement the same. But all the accessory stuff and the type of cardio they're doing change as much as they want it to. As a way to keep them involved. So it's a balancing act because generally people in personal training, they don't come to you with a love and a strong passion for fitness, and then
no,
also
that's true.
Clearly find goals. But when you're working with bodybuilders, they come to you and they've been doing this for years, and they know exactly what they want, and they want you to help them achieve it. So it is a different approach with different populations.
Right, right. So, well, I got one more question just in my head, but I can't seem to think of it right now. How do you approach the general population? So, the general population, how would you go from training, like, someone who wants to step in the gym, doesn't want to have a personal trainer, doesn't want to go on his own, but refers to a online coach. How would you start to do that? Because what I personally do is, I have some structure, like, what is your goal? That's the first document they get. Like, let's just get clear on your goals, because most people just don't know what they actually want. And then just some documents with basic principles of training, basic principles of nutrition. Just let them read through that. And after like 3 to 4 days, when they got through it, we schedule a Skype conversation. Like, what do you want from me? What can I expect from you? All sorts of things. And then I go into the programming and just get a little feel of what the person wants and how he likes to go with things. So how would you do that, Eric?
Yeah, I think the first step is to start communicating with the person, like a Skype call, I guess, in this situation, if it's an online novice, just so that you can help them clearly articulate what their goals are. And then helping them create structure, I find, is one of the biggest hurdles for people. So once you've established a goal, and then you can determine what their schedule is and how much they can make it to the gym, or what kind of time investment they can have, that's when you actually get them into the gym based on, and you create the most ideal program that meets their scheduling demands, with, you know, basically only as much of a stimulus as needed to be effective so that they aren't turned off from the gym, you know, proper kind of intro week, gradually tapering up things, and then just, you know, basic progression kind of built in. And then during that time period, if their goals are nutrition related, just having them generate some basic awareness around nutrition with, you know, looking at food labels and starting to food log, not necessarily for the goal of tracking macros if they're just the basic person, but just trying to get an awareness of their nutrition. That's a good place to start. And so they can get an idea of what their behaviors and habits are, so that we can see what might be a barrier to their goals and we can look at ways to modify them. But yeah, a lot of it, just like you said, I think you're doing it right, is helping them figure out what they actually want. Because if they can't clearly articulate their goals, it's very difficult to stay motivated, and it's very difficult for them to, you know, figure out what to do.
It is. And like I said before, people tend to hop onto new things very quickly when they just get into fitness and just start out. So as a coach, you need to, yeah, in my opinion, get them clear on what they want and then give them a structure on what they need. And after that, you can modify whatever they like to do. But yeah, I've been coaching a couple of people now, and I got someone that was literally interested in fitness the 1 week, bodybuilding next week, powerlifting the week after that, and then he suddenly wanted to get into CrossFit, and I was like, okay, let's just hop onto Skype for like an hour and a half and just talk you down, because what you're doing is not effective towards your goal. So, yeah, that is something most people should consider when they just start out. Get clear on your goal and stick to your structure. Just stick to that, right?
Definitely. I think, you need to have a clearly defined goal and therefore a rather consistent approach to it. Of course, you know, some variation can occur and you should
definitely
enjoy it. But yeah, if you don't have a clearly defined goal, or if it always changes, you won't be reaching any goal. So
I think that's a good place to wrap this podcast up, Eric. We've been going for like 50 minutes right now, and I want to thank you so much for coming to this podcast. And you guys listening out there, Thank you so much for listening to this podcast with Eric Helms, the man, the myth, the legend. And we are out. Is there anything you'd like to say to my audience, Eric?
Just first, I want to thank you for having me on and thank them for listening. And I hope you guys enjoyed it. I certainly did.
Great, great. So we are out.